Good afternoon. I'm Brian Reynolds, County Library Director, with you on Issues and Ideas. Our guests today are Carissa Phelps, author of a very important book, and Christine Tardif, Library Manager with our library system. Carissa, could you tell us a little bit about your book, Runaway Girl?
Well, it's an inspirational memoir, and I wrote it to share my story of being abandoned and ending up on the streets and running from different group homes. The story of what happened there on the streets, and the people that helped me, how I escaped that through the small acts that people extended to me and gave me just a little bit of opportunity that I could hold on to and make changes in my life. And the real story, it begins when the book ends, and that's what I'm doing now to help young women who are in that situation now.
I just feel like for those people who haven't read the book, maybe telling a little bit more about your story. I mean, how did you become abandoned? I mean, how did you end up in juvenile hall? How did you end up on the streets of Fresno?
We're a large family, and a lot of us left home early, and my mom had left home early from the age of 14. She was already running away herself and planning her pregnancy with my father, who she ended up getting pregnant by 16 and marrying. So she had that already in her past, and she had been abandoned when she was 5 years old by her mother and father, and really her development had stopped then, and so she wasn't able to handle teenagers. I mean, it just was that simple. Some people maybe aren't good with babies. She was not good with pre-adolescence and adolescence, and I don't think any books she could have read or anything would have prepared her for that. She needed to have her own process, kind of like what I've been doing here. And so when there was conflict in the house, it often resulted in just huge fights, and it could be physical fighting, and it felt very unsafe, and I ran away from home. I left because one of the things that happened was my stepfather had propositioned my sister for sex, and I was 11, and it made no sense to me why I would continue to live with this unsafe person. And my mom did nothing about it. She felt dependent on him and like she had to stay, and there were just too many kids to leave for one of them. Mm-hmm. And so I left.
Mm-hmm.
And on the streets, when I was on the streets, that's when I started getting involved in crime. Mm-hmm. And that's how I ended up in juvenile hall.
Carissa, my dad happened to be one of 11 children, believe it or not. And one thing I learned from him and his siblings is the older siblings took care of and helped parent the younger generations. Did that not happen in your family?
It absolutely did. I had an older sister that just became like a second mom to me, but she left home when I was about 3. And so that was my first sense of abandonment, probably. She left home because she had to, physically, mentally. She was taking care of 5 children at that time, basically. And my mom she felt was going to keep having kids if she kept caring for them. So she left home after my real father asked her to drop out of school to take care of us. And she decided to stay in school, get a part-time job at A&W, and get herself to community college, and then she went to university, and she really paved the way for me to see what I could do. But she left home at that young age, so we lost some connection.
I know this is getting to some gritty details, but can you tell us how you met Icy? I mean, what happened in that phase of your life?
Yeah, I mean, so by the time I was 12 and trying to make it on my own on the streets, I pretty much knew what men expected of me, and it was not good. I tried to stay with safer people, with women where I could clean their house or watch their kids, but if I didn't have any place to go, sometimes it was the only thing I could do was to end up in a guy's motel room, and it would be usually for a place to stay or a food. And an uncle of a friend took me to a motel one night, and I was scared that night. I thought he was going to keep me for a long time and then probably murder me or just get rid of me, because he was kind of a big gangster guy. And I decided to try to escape. And when I tried to escape, I ended up on a row. It's called Motel Drive or Parkway Drive. And it's these row of seedy motels across from Roding Park on the 99. And when I walked out onto that motel row, I ran into somebody who I wanted to help, and she was herself in her early 20s, 6 months pregnant, beat up. And I just wanted to help her. So I brought her back to my motel room and started talking to her and listening to her story. And she convinced me to call her boyfriend, if she could call her boyfriend. And that was Icy. And he came back to the room and they convinced me that I should help them and go out and make money for them.
Mm-hmm. At what point in your life did you decide to tell your story in this way?
It was in the middle of business school and law school. I was at UCLA and doing the joint program and realized I'm going to grow up when I leave here. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to be in a career. And at first I thought that would be wonderful, make six figures, write a check to the nonprofit of my choice. But then I soon realized that I needed to be involved in the work that I cared about.
Was there a reason that you didn't share your story earlier in your life? I mean, by this time you were an adult.
I think a lot of it was about being shamed, you know, just feeling like maybe there was something that was still my fault involved in all of that, or maybe people could see and maybe think that it was my fault. And at a certain point when I met enough people in the business world and in the helping profession to understand that I was well-equipped and educated and could handle myself in pretty much any circumstances, I became more brave. I was brave, and I was able to speak out and say that I could say who I was and where I came from. It took really going back to that place, though, because I didn't want to just talk about it and then have nightmares about it. I wanted to face it. And so going back to that place and doing it with the documentary film was when things really changed for me.
Had you met other people who had been through something similar and maybe you were modeling what they were able to do to tell the story or help the cause? Or was it something that just came out of your own heart?
Yeah, not up to that point. Actually, I didn't know if I had been the only little girl that had ever been sexually exploited on the street. I really didn't know. I mean, you know, movies that had it in it, I tried to avoid. Stories that had it involved in it, I tried to avoid. I was a social welfare major when I first started at Cal, and I wanted to walk out of the class most of the time because it was so sad for me and so personal for me. And that's why I chose to major in math. And I focused on law and business when I was in law. And I focused on solutions and got an MBA because I really did. I wanted to be solution focused and not focused on the problem as much.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Today we're talking with Christine Tardif, library manager for our county library, and Carissa Phelps, author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. When and how, Carissa, did the idea of writing a book come to you?
Well, after I told the story in the documentary, I realized it really wasn't my medium. I hadn't told the story. I worked with a filmmaker. I was one of the producers, which meant I got a lot of people food and coffee. But I didn't really get into the creative part of telling that story. It was someone else's job too. And I realized then that a lot of people wanted to tell the story and feel sorry for me. And I didn't want that. I didn't want pity. I wasn't looking for anybody to say, oh, what a horrible life you had. And I felt the documentary really, it did a great job telling the story in the short amount of time, but it distanced me from my family in ways because I wasn't able to truly honor them and the gifts that they did give me. And in the book process, I feel like I was able to do that because it's just a fuller story. There's something different in a book than in a movie.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, Carissa, about the documentary and how it was different from the book, but you really gave a good explanation of that. And of course, as a librarian and a book person, I would argue that a book allows you to do that, to get broader and deeper into a topic than just something that's short or video related. Could you, in the book, you talk about some adults that really helped you along the way, Ron and Mrs. Wegerman. Could you talk a little bit about them and who they were and the influence they had?
Yeah, if your audience could see me right now, the video portion, they'd see me smiling because I know I always smile when I think about them. They were the first two people in, I was locked up when it happened, to really give me some positive feedback about myself, to tell me what was right with me. I had enough people telling me what was wrong with me. I had judges and lawyers and therapists and counselors and parents telling me what was wrong with me. But they were really the first people that said, you have potential and you're good at math, you're good at algebra, and I think you can do this, and really showed me what was right with me.
Are you surprised by the number of children who are sexually exploited, who are having to walk the streets, even at 12, even younger than you, even?
I am surprised. I thought that when I was writing those checks to the nonprofit or when I was going out and doing this work that it would be in another country. Mm-hmm. I thought it was happening somewhere else, and that's why I've been on a big media and awareness push, is because it's happening here. We even have sex tourism here in the United States. We have people that come to the United States and they order girls off of the internet. I uncovered a sex tourism ring going on right at a popular hotel right in L.A. And it was a tour bus from India, and a local Indian person just ordering girls off of the internet and bringing them to the hotel. And nobody wanted to do anything about it. And so we're still on the awareness. We're still on how do we take action, realize that we have things like sex tourism going on in the U.S.
Carissa, when you say girls, do you mean underage girls, not adults?
I do. I mean underage girls. I mean, I looked in the eyes of a 13-year-old girl who had just been raped at this hotel, and she ran from me because she was scared, because no one's ever approached her to try to help her, but she was a girl.
Who's running these tours?
Well, I mean, that's for us to uncover, because I had no idea they existed. I would have written about them in the book if I did, and I just uncovered it, and it surprised me. And I continue to be surprised by how many and where the market is and who are the buyers, and we just have a lot to uncover.
Well, are these girls, are they usually shipped in from overseas as to be in the sex trade, or they tend to be from girls
some,
like yourself on the
Some will, but most of them are domestic, actually. Mm-hmm. Most of the girls are domestic. They, what the common theme usually is they don't have family. Mm-hmm. A lot of them don't have family or have broken families or have challenges in their families, and or they have generations of their mom's been sexually exploited, maybe their grandmother, some 3-4 generations of sexual exploitation. Mm-hmm.
Carissa, there's many things that are just surprising and disturbing about the whole theme, but related to what Christine just asked you, but it seems like if you're surprised and you were in the business at one time, is it your assessment that a lot of people are surprised or that the subject is just not very well known or recognized?
Yeah, I think people are surprised because they don't want to see it for what it is. It might be too overwhelming. It might be that it's easier to ignore because it's easier to deal with if we think it's their choice. But this is often, it's like domestic violence. If we just blame the victim and we don't realize that there's something else going on and somebody being victimized, then we'll never get that person help.
Well, you were saying in the book that the law labels these children as offenders and not as victims. I mean, can you talk more about that, especially what you're doing now to try and change that?
Yeah, there's a conflict in laws right now. Since 2003, the federal law has said that children under the age of 18 that are sold for sex are victims of sex trafficking. It just makes no sense because they cannot consent. They cannot sell their own bodies, okay? So it's just like it's statutory slavery or whatever you want to call it. It's definitely slavery. If they're under 18 years old, the federal law is very clear about that. Now, the state law and the states all have varying degrees of what they think is legal or illegal, but they'll have misdemeanor offenses against girls that are 14, 13, some 11-year-old girls. They'll pick them up, handcuff them, and charge them with prostitution when they can't even make a choice to have a sex with an adult. They can't even make that choice. They can't even consent. It would be like going in and arresting one of the Sandusky victims. I mean, it's that horrendous. But again, it's sometimes difficult to see it that way.
Does law enforcement, in your opinion, concentrate over much on the victims or the young girls, let's say, as opposed to the people behind the scene, the pimps and so forth?
Over 95% of the arrests for prostitution-related offenses are of the victim, of the person that is being exploited. So, and only a portion of those are adult victims. And then the girls oftentimes are told to lie about their age. And I've seen 13, 14-year-old girls so dressed up to a T that sometimes they can pass. Sometimes they're 6 foot tall. They're amazingly beautiful young women, but they'll just tell a cop they're 18. The cops will book them and let them out, and it's an easier job for them than what they would have to do to process a minor.
Easy. That's kind of a chilling term. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is Brian Reynolds, and we're on Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Today we're joined by Christine Tardiff, Library Manager with the County Library System, and by Carissa Phelps, author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time.
So, Carissa, what is your relationship with your family now? I mean, I saw the documentary and I've read the book, and I know it's been a struggle for both of your parents, you know, dare I say that, to really admit their culpability. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, and I stopped looking for that, I think, a long time ago for them to kind of own up to it. Mm-hmm. Because if they knew what they did, then they probably wouldn't have done it. If they had the capacity to understand that, they probably wouldn't have made those choices. I don't believe that my parents were evil people. I just think they made really bad choices. And that's why I know this could happen to anyone.
What has been the hardest thing for you to overcome in this whole process, Carissa?
Ignorance. You know, when I was first going out and sharing my story, some people would... I worked in finance. I worked in private equity. So there, I was around billions of dollars when it was about 2006, 2007. And, you know, things were kind of moving really fast all around me. And I would get traipsed around, and people who I thought were my friends would introduce me like, here's Carissa. I want to tell you her amazing story. She's a former child prostitute. And it was just hard because I'm not that. I'm a lawyer. I have an MBA. I have a mind. I have an opinion. I have work to do here in this world. And I was getting seriously pigeonholed into a survivor and used to, you know, just to be a sad story. And I think that has been really difficult to overcome in telling my story.
So what made you so resilient and determined while so many people have been through something similar to what you've been through just never seem to rise above, you know, the shame and self-hate and that they go through?
Well, I think there are many survivors out there who rise above and who have successful, amazing lives and are happy and are productive and contribute and raise beautiful children and use all of their experiences to inform their decisions. And I just don't think their stories are told as much. And they may be, you know, working at a local grocery store. I don't know where they are, but I really believe, especially since I've been out on the book tour and when I was out with the documentary, that it could be anyone that has suffered this. I mean, I've had VPs come up to me from companies. I've had, you know, just anyone you can imagine, any walk of life, any race, and people come up to me in tears and they say, me too, me too. And so to know that, and the range is everything from, you know, I left home at 17 and I got pushed into working in a topless bar and men exploited me there. It starts, you know, it's from there to it started when I was 9 years old. It goes across the range, and I've just realized that I'm not so special after all. Like, I really believe I share this story. It's very common in a way. It's uncommon and horrific in many ways, but when you share it and when you gain that sense of survivorship and you're not alone in it, I think it's helpful.
So you've been speaking to kids in the, you know, juvenile hall, and what's that been like for you?
It was one of the biggest challenges at one point because I thought I wanted to save them all. I went in thinking, I'm going to come in, I'm going to solve all your problems. I'm a lawyer now. Even when I was a law student, I thought I had some skill and I would fix things for them. And that was a mistake. I can't fix everything. I can't come in and just take away all those problems. I can't take away years of abuse. I can't take away years of neglect. What I can do is I could make the laws maybe respond a little bit smarter. I could train people and have them be a little bit more compassionate and understanding. But I could not take away all the harm that had been done to them.
Mm-hmm. Carissa, you probably speak to all kinds of groups, and Christine just mentioned inmates in juvenile hall. Are there certain groups that you feel you either like to talk to or having talked to them could make a difference more than others?
Adult women who are in prison, I've done some of that work, and to me that's so powerful because they're just like me. They're my sisters. They're survivors. They've experienced similar lives and just ended up in a different place. So that's very powerful for me going into those places. And one of the young women that I would love to visit and go see is in Chowchilla prison now, and her name is Sarah Cruzan, and she was serving life without the possibility of parole for murdering her pimp trafficker, the person who had abused her since she was 11 and started selling her when she was 13. And she got as much time. I mean, if you think about it, as like the Green River Killer, who murdered, and she was a kid, really. And it was the whole story is of her life was tragic. But she's my age. She's 34, and she's sitting in prison. And I really feel like she's kind of like our Mandela. Mm-hmm. And I want to speak, you know, with her. I want to see her out here doing this work. I think it's important.
You read about, Carissa, you read about women that are in abusive relationships, and from time to time they fight back to protect themselves. It seems to me like the laws are shifting in their favor, where if they do protect themselves and that results in violence against the abuser, that they are held a little bit harmless. But it sounds like in the case of this lady, that didn't happen.
No, the laws were very new on the books at that time, as far as intimate partner violence and sentencing and that coming into play for sentencing. They did a lot of things wrong in her case when they sentenced her. And her sentence was, when Schwarzenegger was on his way out, it was commuted and she was eligible for parole. But right now, we've got Kamala Harris, who's looking at the case and possibly can serve some justice and get that heard. So
why did you decide to go to law school? And then the secondary question is, in the middle of law school, why pick up an MBA along the way?
So law school, I had this idea that if I was a lawyer, I would be able to change things. That's what I thought. I had a dreamy idea about it. And it was funny because as soon as I got into UCLA, people started to say, are you sure you want to be a lawyer? And these were lawyers. The first lawyers I was meeting, I was kind of bragging, oh, I'm going to go to UCLA. I was so proud. And they were discouraging me and saying, oh, you know, there's nothing really you could do as a lawyer. And I found out in law school that it's a challenging career, especially if you wanted to do something different and if you wanted to do social change and public interest, it was difficult. So I chose to focus on business law. I chose to learn more about our economic system and how it worked and how business functioned and how that impacted our lives. And when I realized during my law studies that I needed more of a background in business, I added the MBA. And I was able to do that because of my math background.
So in the book, you talk about getting the MBA because you wanted to learn how to sort of play the game.
Yeah.
You know, to bring money to your cause. Did that work? I mean, did it help you now, you know, with what you're doing?
It's funny because the people I met at the MBA school are the most kind, compassionate, giving, loving, amazing people, and they became my network. I mean, I met Marks there, who ended up being one of my mentors, and he's he was a guest professor at a class, and he's brilliant. I didn't meet those type of people at law school, maybe a few, but I met them at business school, and I can remember people being like, you're going to the dark side of business, and I only saw light. I only saw positivity over there. So I really think business is going to be leading us in social change.
More and more you see about businesses being socially conscious, like green businesses, and we certainly want to believe that there's going to be profit there too, that helping the world be a better place, you know, you also can make a living.
And there definitely is. There definitely is a way to do both.
I'd like to remind our listening audience, this is Brian Reynolds on KCBX Issues and Ideas. We're talking with library manager Christine Tardif and author and youth advocate Carissa Phelps, author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time.
Yeah, it's funny. Before we came in here, Brian and I were talking about law school and how there's sort of this hierarchy that those who choose to go into child advocacy law are considered kind of a little lower on the pecking order. Did you get that sense when you were in law school that, you know, you wanted to save people? Did people say, well, what the heck? You know, go take the six figures. What are you worrying about those kids for?
Well, I wasn't. It's funny. Nobody in law school knew my story. Mm. I didn't feel safe in law school to share my story. It's a very competitive environment, very competitive. And so in law school, I actually was one of the six-figure people. I was going for being a corporate lawyer. That's what I was going for.
Okay. Would you consider in your career then, Carissa, changing to being an advocate for children?
Well, I am, I think, with my voice, what I've become is an advocate for youth. But I'm also, with my corporation, which is a flexible purpose corporation, which is a new form here in California that a bunch of lawyers and business people fought for. It allows me to have a charitable purpose and have a profit-driven motive as well. So I am able to provide sustainable jobs for survivors, and that to me is key. How can I ask somebody to turn their life around and not give them any meaningful employment or opportunity?
Can you tell us more about that? What you're doing right now?
Yeah, okay. It's called Runaway Girl FPC. We're a flexible purpose corporation, and what we strive to do is offer employment for and opportunities for survivors, people that have been on the streets, who have run away, who have maybe been sexually exploited or been exposed to that. We offer training, so training for law enforcement, training for counselors, and people can either share their story or not. We have a script that could be followed for training. We train community, and it's called CPR, Community Protocol for Response, on sexual exploitation of youth. And we train like group home staff and people that work with youth in a longer term basis in empowerment model training. So we have different courses, and we involve local survivors to do it nationwide. And we are also looking into a legal document preparation business, because the LDA business is growing. And I have a hunch that a lot of these young people know the legal documents pretty well. So we want to teach them on preparation and get them out doing charitable work in the community, helping people in domestic violence shelters with restraining orders or with divorce or anything like that we can do in the community, and then also giving them training so that they could provide those services for a living later on.
So where have you done some of this training? What type of organizations do you work with? Has it been just locally?
Yeah, group homes. I've worked out in the Valley because I have connections out there, and that's where I've done a lot of the work that I'm doing. We've done a training with Madera County for their child abuse and prevention. We are looking at Los Angeles doing their Department of Children and Family Services emergency response team. So that's a critical time, a critical moment when the kids are picked up, and it matters how they're treated and where they're placed. So I've worked with LA County Probation, Fresno County Probation, and then across the country, I'm invited to go and speak and do trainings. And law enforcement, and you had a question about this earlier, they are starting to want to change, but it takes not just the chief or the managers in that organization. It takes the line level people, the people that are on the ground, and there's a lot of training that needs to be done for that to happen.
Probably, Carissa, though, the motive, I mean, it has to start at the top. It may not end there, you know, with the street cop or whatever, but you'd have to have the top people on board, wouldn't you say?
And we do. I think we do. We do have the top people. We're going to see some federal legislation, I think, come out that protects foster youth, because foster youth are being targeted, and we see that sexually exploited youth are predominantly foster youth. Karen Bass is working on that, and she'll get something going where they're going to be required to do this training, and if they're not already on board, they're going to get on board.
Carissa, I'd like to shift gears a little bit to the gender issue. There are probably abused kids of both genders, boys and girls. Is there a difference in the numbers or how the boys versus the girls are treated?
A big difference in how they're treated. Boys are ignored completely. Girls are arrested, which I think does harm. Boys are ignored, completely ignored. So for years, I mean, it's the same neighborhoods. Now it's on websites as well, but boys would be lined up in Hollywood in certain streets, and they're still there. And there's the boys' side of the street and the girls' side of the street, and the girls get arrested, and the boys are completely ignored.
Why is that?
Well, I think that if you asked a vice unit how they set up their vice squad to deal with quote-unquote prostitution, which is the selling of the sexual act, right, they would say they usually probably send in a man to pose as a John, and they'd set up the situation to – it's usually a girl they're targeting. It's a young woman they're targeting, and they're arresting. If they started arresting the boys, I think things would get interesting. You know, because I think we'd have to deal with the social issue in a different way. We'd have to look at it in a different way. Instead, we just ignore that completely.
That's pretty scary. Carissa, do you have any opinions on the Penn State Jerry Sandusky issue? You alluded to it earlier.
I do. I mean, I think it's horrible. My heart goes out to the victims and their families, and they're survivors now. And anything that I could do, or if they resonate at all with my story, I'm here to be a part of any type of survivor network. I support our local rape crisis center and rape crisis centers across the country. I think they do amazing work. And I would just ask anybody who's been victimized or sexually exploited or sexually abused to go out and seek services through their local rape crisis center. It's a profound change it can make in your life when you have support and you have an agency that's trained in empowerment and doing outreach. So I just say to seek local help. And then with the Sandusky case, you know, it brings up a lot for me because I think the victims I see on a day-to-day basis, they're treated so poorly by society. You know, I have a young woman right now that I'm calling dentists around California trying to find her a way to get her teeth replaced because she was beat up so bad that she's lost two teeth and she was left to die. She is, you know, very beat up in a lot of different ways, and we're doing other things for her as well. But, you know, it's imagine if Sandusky had not only raped them, but had beaten them and knocked their teeth out and kicked their legs and run them over and done all these things that I know happen to these girls on a daily basis.
One of the things I can't believe is that apparently people at Penn State at the very highest levels knew this was going on, and maybe it's been going on for a decade or more, and yet they didn't speak out. They didn't raise the red flag. Do you have an opinion about that?
I think people get scared and they get frozen, and it's not an excuse at all. We need to have continual ongoing training and empowerment of the people that protect our youth, because I know as a school teacher, when I was a high school teacher, there were mandated reporting trainings and there were things that we went through, but there wasn't really active protocol in place for us to take steps and do intervention, and we needed that. And colleges obviously need that. Anybody that comes in contact with youth, I'm doing community protocol for response, CPR, because I think everybody needs it.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Today we're interviewing Carissa Phelps, author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time. And I'm joined by library manager Christine Tardif.
Carissa, what can be done, what can the average person do to help prevent children being exploited?
Well, there's an easy thing, because in November, Proposition 35 will be on your ballot. So the CASE Act, Proposition 35, will change things for young youth that have been sexually exploited. It'll provide more resources, and it will allow them to be treated as victims instead of as criminals. So that is one of the steps that we could take here locally and in California, is with Proposition 35. I struggle with, especially living here and being a local, people telling me all the time, it doesn't happen here. It doesn't happen here. But that people tell me that all over the country. So I know it happens here, and I know it happens in every community. I know it happens out in Avenel, on the I-5. I know it happens out in the rural areas. And it's finding out, I think, from your local law enforcement, your local child protective service agency, your local schools, what is their plan for response? Don't you want to know? I mean, you want to know. You want to know that somebody is trained to respond to that when it's happening and if it's happening. And I think that that's where people might be surprised, that there's either nothing in place or that the policy and the procedure is to arrest and detain.
Carissa, what message would you like to leave listeners with, especially those that might want to help or those who have suffered some of the experiences that you have?
Hope. Hope. That's so critical that we hang on to that. And connection to your community and to individuals. If you're a survivor, make those connections, start to build trust, and trust yourself.
You talked earlier about you know, like a rape crisis center, but what about somebody who is an adult now and looking, who hasn't told their story like you have? What options do they have? What would you say to them?
Locally here at our SARP center, I went through the 40-hour California crisis training, and I would advise that for any adult, any person who has, you don't have to tell your story when you're in there. They happen to have my documentary and they show it in that training, but I didn't have to tell my story. I could have asked them not to show the documentary. You can go in and learn about the issue and see where you can fit in our community. There's a whole host of community members that come in during the training, and it would show you different opportunities that you might have to work in the community if you're interested in that. And if not, you just walk away with a great set of tools for conflict management and empowerment tools and all kinds of things to deal with crisis.
What are your future plans?
Well, the business is what I'm focused on right now, and expanding that. We have a third business that I didn't mention yet, but it's social service technology innovation. So I'm venturing into the technology space a little bit with a former foster youth who also happens to be a social worker and a computer scientist. And so she and myself and two others, including a rocket engineer who's our programmer, we've been coming up with some solutions to placement issues, because placement is such a mess when it comes to crisis and to children and people in need needing to be placed.
I just have to ask this question before, and we're getting close to the end, Carissa. Where does your financing come from? How do you make the corporation work?
Well, we're very entrepreneurial, bootstrapping for sure. The success of some of the other work that I've done has helped me to do some self-financing, and I have an investor.
That's wonderful news. I'd like to tie in the library just a little bit, because we like to think of public libraries as a help, as a resource, where people can make sense out of things that seem not sensible, where people can get some other resources. We do have in our county library system lots of resources for people, books, websites. We refer people to the 211 network. And I also know that we're planning on co-hosting an upcoming program with Carissa to talk about her book and hopefully get some people in to hear more information. So, Carissa, Christine, thank you so much. It's been a wonderful event on a topic that's not so nice. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you,
Christine.
This is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas. Today we've been discussing child abuse issues with author and youth advocate Carissa Phelps, author of Runaway Girl, Escaping Life on the Streets, One Helping Hand at a Time.